I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, an Egyptian man's beating highlights police tactics. Israel hints at responsibility for an airstrike in Syria.
That's another proof that when we say something, we mean it. We say that we don't think that it should be allowable to bring advanced weapon systems into Lebanon.
Two top U.S. officials are asked about Iran's nuclear ambitions. And British authorities launch an investigation after pork is found in pies labeled halal. It's all ahead. The recent beating of an Egyptian man has highlighted the nation's brutal police tactics and called into question the current role of the police, 2 years after the supposed end of a police state. VOA's Elizabeth Arad has this report from Cairo.
The violence that has seized Egypt since late last month is to many sadly familiar. Angry young men provoke police. Police respond with excessive force. Both sides are counted among the dead and wounded, as are bystanders. But it was the image of one protester, broadcast live, that has brought new outrage in a country long used to police brutality. A video of 48-year-old Hamada Sabir outside the presidential palace, stripped naked, kicked, and beaten by police, provided the first shock. And then there was the follow-up. At first, after being taken into custody, Sabir said it was protesters who hurt him. The police, he said from a police hospital bed, had helped him. But Sabir later recanted, blaming police for the beating. His hospital statement brought to mind countless cases of police coercion, part of a larger system of injustice that helped fuel Egypt's uprising 2 years ago. Political activist and blogger Wael Khalil.
This oppressive apparatus hasn't changed a bit at all. I mean, it's working with the same rule book. It's still untouchable. No one is accountable.
The interior minister warned that without the police, Egypt could become a militia state like some of its neighbors. But in a rare move from on high, President Mohamed Morsi's office has promised an investigation into the beating. The president's supporters say there's a sincere drive to overhaul the police. A senior official of the Muslim Brotherhood's political party, Amr Darag, contends they inherited a system whose role was to protect the government from opposition.
We are going to the right direction, but still there is a lot for the police force to learn and to get rehabilitated in order to be able to deal with that.
But how much influence Mr. Morsi has or is willing to use is unclear. Interior Ministry reform has been slow. Even as simple a change as emphasizing riot control over confrontation. One opponent of the president mocked his apparent inability to control the police in a message on Twitter. The only thing worse than a dictator, he wrote, is a dictator who cannot dictate. But even as Egypt's police are heavy-handed in some crowds, they are absent in others. In Cairo's Tahrir Square, violence has increased, in particular the sexual assault of women by mobs of men. Only civilian volunteers, not police, are trying to protect them. What is clear is that 7 months into Mr. Morsi's presidency, Egyptians are expecting their president to do more. Elizabeth Arad, VOA News, Cairo.
A top Iranian official says Israel will regret its latest aggression against Syria. The head of Iran's National Security Council, Saeed Jalili, said today in a visit to Damascus that the Muslim world supports Syria. Jalila's comments came a day after Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak said last week's airstrike in Syria shows Israel is serious about preventing heavy weapons from flowing into Lebanon. Robert Berger has more on the story from Jerusalem.
After days of silence, Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak has hinted his country was behind last week's airstrike in Syria. Damascus accused Israel of attacking a research facility last Wednesday, while foreign media reports said Israeli jets hit a convoy transferring Russian-made anti-aircraft missiles to the Islamic militant group Hezbollah in Lebanon. Speaking at an international security conference in Germany, Barak said Israel had warned in advance the transfer of sophisticated weapons to terrorist groups is a red line that must not be crossed.
That's another proof that when we say something, we mean it. We say that we don't think that it should be allowable to bring advanced weapon systems into Lebanon.
In Damascus, Syrian President Bashar Assad was quoted as saying The airstrike is proof Israel is conspiring with foreign forces to destabilize Syria. The growing tensions with Syria coincide with Israel's formation of a new government 2 weeks after national elections. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the proliferation of heavy weapons in Syria poses a major challenge as he begins a third term in office. But as he began coalition talks in Jerusalem on Sunday, Mr. Netanyahu said the biggest threat Israel faces is from Iran. He said the top priority of his new government will be to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons. Iran says its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes, but Israel sees it as a threat to its existence and has warned a preemptive strike on Iran's nuclear facilities remains an option. Mr. Netanyahu sounded a more conciliatory note on the Palestinians, saying he hopes to revive peace talks that have been deadlocked for 4 years over Jewish settlement expansion. He said he plans to form a broad national unity government with Israeli moderates who support the peace process. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
The United Nations Refugee Agency says it has brought winter emergency relief to thousands of internally displaced people in northern Syria. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UNHCR says it has delivered 15,000 blankets and 3,000 tents to the Azaz area in northwestern Syria, where thousands of victims of Syria's civil war are living in makeshift camps. The agency airlifted the relief items from its central warehouse in Copenhagen to a civilian airport near Latakia on the Syrian coast. From there, it was transported by road in an 8-truck convoy to an area between the city of Aleppo and the Syrian-Turkish border. The Syrian government and the opposition Syrian National Coalition provided logistical support in the battle-ravaged area. Yaqub El Hilo, the director of UNHCR's Middle East and North African Bureau, says aid gaps remain. He says that in the future, the UNHCR will bring in relief items from its regional stockpile in neighboring Jordan to help speed up the aid process.
And what we are doing now is open this access from within the country, hoping that this will be maintained because the momentum has now been built with the support of all sides. And it is indeed our aim, not only as UNHCR, but also as the interagency family inside Syria, to move the next convoy in the next few days with larger quantities of aid to this population in that part of the country, but also many other parts of the country where displaced families are today in disputed areas and not only in government-controlled areas.
A month-long UN mission to the Western Syrian Governorate of Homs has found that about 700,000 people are impacted by the violence in the region, with many of them displaced. A spokeswoman for the UN Children's Fund, Marixi Mercado, says children comprise half of the 420,000 people in need of urgent humanitarian assistance.
According to partners, almost one in three people in Homs is a displaced person, and about two-thirds of the displaced are below 18 years old. The Homs mission found that out of some 1,500 schools, around 200 have been damaged as a result of the fighting, and around 65 are now hosting displaced families. Across Syria, one in four schools has been damaged or destroyed, or is being used as a shelter for the displaced.
A UNICEF official says the children need psychological and other support to help them cope with their traumatic experiences. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
VOA invites you to share a glimpse of your life through photography and become eligible to win a new iPad. VOA helps give you insights into the world around us. Now we want you to share your world with us. Send us your best photo, one that captures the spirit or the essence of the people and places in your life. You may enter as many photos as you like. VOA's judges will choose a winner. For a complete list of contest rules and to upload your photo, go to voanews.com/iPad. The contest ends February 21st, 2013, so enter today and good luck. Iran said it is open to a U.S. offer for direct talks on its nuclear program and that it expects to resume negotiations with world powers later this month. Foreign Minister Ali Akbar Salehi said Sunday that the six world powers, the United States, China, Russia, Britain, France, and Germany, plan to resume talks in Kazakhstan on February 25th, calling that good news. A spokeswoman for EU Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton, who coordinates the efforts of the six powers, confirmed that she had proposed talks in Kazakhstan that week. EU officials have accused Iran of delaying tactics in weeks of discussions over the date and venue for new talks. Mr. Salehi also described as a step forward the suggestion the day before by U.S. Vice President Joe Biden that Washington was ready for direct talks with Iran if Tehran was serious about negotiations. He spoke at a panel discussion during an annual international security conference in Munich. Iran and the so-called P5 plus one group held three rounds of talks last year aimed at easing the standoff over its nuclear activities, which Tehran insists are peaceful, but the West suspects are intended to give Iran the capacity to build an atomic weapon. Appearing Sunday on the NBC program Meet the Press, outgoing Defense Secretary Leon Panetta and the top U.S. military officer, Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Army General Martin Dempsey, were asked by reporter Chuck Todd about Iran's nuclear ambitions. The first to speak was Secretary Panetta.
What I've said, and I will say today, is that the intelligence we have is they have not made the decision to proceed with the development of a nuclear weapon. They are developing and enriching uranium. They continue to do that. They continue to work at
developing
nuclear capability.
Why do you believe they're doing that?
I think it's a clear indication. They say they're doing it in order to develop their own energy source. I think it is suspect that they continue to enrich uranium because that is dangerous and that violates international.
You do believe they're probably pursuing a weapon, but you don't. The intelligence doesn't.
No, I can't tell you because I can't tell you they are in fact pursuing a weapon because that's not what intelligence says they're doing right now. But every indication is they want to continue to increase their nuclear capability. And that's a concern, and that's what we're asking them to stop doing.
General Dempsey, you've been very careful. Do we have the capability to stop this militarily?
We have the capability. They're a very disruptive, malicious influence in Syria. They smuggle weapons. They're active in any number of ways. We have the capability to provide options to the president in any number of scenarios to include their acquisition of nuclear weapons.
So, because you were careful before never to say you wanted them to think that we did. But you were careful never to say you were. So we have the capability to stop this.
Well, you know, stopping is a decision they would make in a political sense, the same way that other nations make decisions. We could.
You have the military plans
to destroy their capability, but intentions have to be influenced through other means.
U.S. Defense Secretary Panetta and General Dempsey were also asked about Friday's suicide bombing at the U.S. Embassy in Ankara. Saturday, a radical Turkish Marxist group claimed responsibility for the attack, in which a Turkish guard was killed. Again, the first to speak is Mr. Panetta.
Well, the important things to do are, first of all, you've got to build up the host country capacity. In the end, these embassies do depend on host country details that provide security. The second is you got to harden these embassies as much as possible. And the third is that we've been working with the State Department to determine whether additional Marines ought to be assigned to that area. And in the end, then, you know, the final alternative is our ability to respond and having our troops in a position where they can respond quickly. But I have to tell you, a lot of that still is dependent on whether intelligence tells us that we've got a problem and gives us enough warning so that we can get to the place so that we can respond.
Did you have enough time to get there in time? You didn't have enough warning, General Dempsey.
No,
to Benghazi.
We did not.
And is there anything that could have been done better on the intelligence front, you think, that could have given you more time to do something? Or is this something that, you know, this is what happens in a place like Libya?
We've learned a lot from the Benghazi incident. And we, as the Secretary said, we've worked with the State Department and kind of surveying those parts of the world where there's a new norm, if you will, of instability. In terms of discussing the intelligence apparatus, it's pretty easy to talk about the intelligence failures. We don't talk much about them many times when we have intelligence and we're able to stop or prevent or disrupt an attack. So, of course, we should continue to learn from these events.
Is Turkey a success? What the stopping of, you know, he was stopped at the perimeter. Should we see that as a success?
Well, I think the fact that that was at the perimeter, the fact that he got nowhere close to where the embassy was, I think that was a good security in terms of preventing it. The fact that we were able to locate that Dow that had man pads on it and be able to respond to that is an example of good intelligence being able to guide us so that we could prevent something more serious from happening.
British authorities launched an investigation and suspended a company that supplies meat to prisons after pork DNA was found in meat pies labeled halal. In swift action taken in hopes of avoiding a backlash, officials also called a meeting of all major food suppliers. The director of the Food Standards Agency, Steve Warner, reacted to the find.
It's completely unacceptable that people from certain faiths have unknowingly eaten food containing ingredients that are prohibited by their religious beliefs. And it's absolutely the responsibility of the food industry to make sure the food they sell is what's on the label.
The halal certification is given to foods that meet Islam's dietary guidelines. Under Islamic law, Muslims are forbidden to eat pork. Officials said all prisons have been informed and the halal-labeled products were withdrawn immediately. Some people, like this butcher, Will Woodard, blame the price structure for the contamination.
Gradually, as prices get driven down by consumers and by supermarkets, there's always going to be someone at the bottom looking to cut corners.
The tests on the so-called halal foods were commissioned after it emerged that some British supermarkets were selling beef burgers that contained horse meat. The Baltimore Ravens are Super Bowl champions of the U.S. National Football League, winning a thrilling 34-31 victory over the San Francisco 49ers in a game that produced surprises throughout. VOA's Jim Stevenson has more from the Superdome in New Orleans.
The contest was a tale of similarities on opposing sidelines, highlighted by two brothers, John and Jim Harbaugh, as the head coaches. Baltimore's 22-point lead nearly evaporated in the second half Sunday before John's team prevailed.
I just knew with Jim Harbaugh being on the other sideline and all those years that we've been together, that game was going to be a dogfight right to the end, that those guys were coming back. What they've done the last 2 years in the National Football League is unprecedented. And they showed it today, the way they battled back and fought right to the end.
Baltimore owned a solid 21-6 lead at halftime and opened the second half with Jacoby Jones running for a Super Bowl record 108-yard kickoff return for a touchdown. Then the lights went out. A power failure stopped play for about 30 minutes. San Francisco regrouped and came within 2 points of Baltimore at 31-29 in the fourth quarter. A Ravens field goal and an impressive goal line defensive stand in the final 2 minutes held off what would have been the greatest comeback in Super Bowl history. Ravens quarterback and Super Bowl most valuable player Joe Flacco explains.
We're a tough blue-collar city, and that's the way our games tend to come down to. You know, we're up 28-6. I'm sure a lot of people were nervous, but we're kind of like, oh, this might be pretty easy. And the next thing you know, the Niners get right back into it and play great football, and we just had to grind one out.
The win also sent veteran star linebacker Ray Lewis into retirement with wins in both Super Bowl championships for the Ravens, the first in 2001. At the Superdome in New Orleans, Louisiana, Jim Stevenson, VOA Sports.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.